Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Earlier this month, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported the U.S. unemployment rate for February registered 3.8%. That's 0.2% lower than it registered for January. Meanwhile, the labor force participation rate registered 63.2%, unchanged from the level it registered for January. Behind those numbers lies the very human stories of people looking for work. And while the numbers sound promising, there are a few unwelcome indications once you unpack the statistics as well. Joe Santos is professor of macroeconomics at South Dakota State University, and he joins us today for Morning Macro. You can follow along on his blog, schooled.blog.com, and he's joining us in the Janine Basinger studio at South Dakota State. Joe, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Lori.
All right. In order for us to understand the Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers, we might want to start with some definitions. So let's talk about things like job separation and the unemployment rate. Where would you like to begin?
Sure. So let's start with the unemployment rate. So when the Bureau of Labor Statistics reports this unemployment rate, what they're doing is surveying about 60,000 households, and they're surveying the adult members of those households, and they're asking them some seemingly basic questions about their employment status. So essentially, what the BLS wants to know, number one, is if this individual is in the labor force. And that means either you're employed, that's fairly straightforward, or you're actively seeking work, and so you're unemployed. And so either of those two conditions would place you in the labor force. There's also the possibility, of course, that you're not in the labor force. And the simplest way to think about this, perhaps, is someone who answers that they are a stay-at-home parent, they're a full-time student, they're retired, and so on. And in that case, they're out of the labor force. So what the BLS does with these numbers is actually fairly straightforward. They take the number of people who responded in a way that the BLS reasons is unemployed, and they divide that by the labor force. And so this is this unemployment rate that you reported in your lead-in. So 3.8% is, as if you were to use that in a sentence, 3.8% of the labor force responded to that survey in such a way that the BLS determined those individuals were unemployed. They were, again, actively seeking work, very much a part of that process of trying to reattach themselves to the an employed position, but at the moment, not there.
So I want to know a little bit more about those people who are out of the labor force, because it's hard. We can't brush past that because it's millions of people. Is that tracked or parsed down anywhere? Because it seems like we could tell a lot from the people who are out of the labor force, especially when we look at retirees, students, and stay-at-home parents.
Right. That's right. And those are the simple examples. Yeah. The reality, as your very good question alludes to, is actually more complicated, more interesting. There's a lot of movement between the labor force and out of the labor force pools, and in particular, a lot of movement from the state we would call unemployment to out of the labor force. Stay-at-home parents and retirees, that's fairly straightforward. But we also have folks who the BLS refers to as marginally attached individuals. And so these are folks who are not actively seeking work, at least had not been during the 4 weeks prior to the survey, but they respond in such a way that indicates they would be happy to take work if they could find it. Sometimes your listeners will hear the term discouraged worker, which is a bit misleading because they are precisely not working. The discouraged worker is someone who is so-called marginally attached, and for economic reasons that they cite, they have no longer, they've given up their search for work. So it can include those folks who, again, technically sort of disqualify themselves, if you will, from being in the labor force. So they are out of it, but their situation is very different than the situation of, say, a retiree or the full-time college student we referred to earlier. And we've seen a drop in the labor force participation rate. That's another one of these ratios that the BLS reports. And again, that's very simply saying, okay, who is in the labor force? You put that in the top of the fraction. In the bottom, you put the entire adult population. And that percentage, at least since about 2000 or so, has been declining. And some of that we understand. It's just demographics. Baby boomers are retiring, and some of it is that simple. But some of it is not so simple. And as I say, we suspect a significant portion of that is the so-called marginally attached worker who has largely involuntarily exited the labor force.
All right. So again, looking at what all is broken down, there's no, you know, look at what kind of industries might be facing unemployment. It's just whether you're working, whether you're not, whether you're part of this labor force, and if you are, whether you're employed or unemployed. But they're not looking at, you know, coal miners or teachers or, you know, tech workers. They're not parsing that out.
Sure. So it's a great question. So the headline numbers do not parse that out. It is very much a macroeconomic statistic in that you're attempting to assess the labor market broadly defined. So what are the general features of the labor market? If your listeners go on to the BLS's website, bls.gov, they can lose, you know, a good part of a week diving into the sort of the granularity of the data. But yeah, at the as I like to say, at 50,000 feet, we look down and we see, you know, 3.8%. Or we do look down from 50,000 feet in different ways. So another admittedly broad measure, one that doesn't capture the kind of granularity you were just referring to, school teachers and coal miners and so on, but nevertheless, one that is a bit more informative, is a unemployment rate that includes folks, these marginally attached folks, even folks who say they're, you know, they're working part time, but they reveal, you know, I'd rather work full time if I had the opportunity. You know, we put those in the category of unemployed in this one case, and we published a statistic we affectionately refer to as U6, which is a much broader measure, and these are both on the school.blog website. But you can see during the Great Recession, this broader measure rose to about 18%. So we do recognize that any fair assessment of the labor market, albeit a macroeconomic perspective on that market, really requires a little more granularity. So I encourage your listeners to take a look at this so-called U6 measure, which again just creates, if you will, a larger numerator. It says, all right, let's count folks who have given up work, folks who say they're part-time but would rather be full-time. Let's put all of them into the hopper as well. And if you do that, you get a significantly larger number, almost twice the headline unemployment number that you let in with.
So is that reported? You know, when you hear, you know, Marketplace on NPR, you look at the headlines in your favorite local print newspaper, is it going to say U6 and U3? I've never heard those terms before, and we should remind people that they can go online at school.blog.com. If you have a hard time finding that, we've put a link up at listen.sdpb.org, so you can go there right now. That link is up now as you follow along with the graphs on Joe Santos' website. But the question is, again, this U3, U6 seem like unfamiliar terms to me. How do we know which number we're looking at when the numbers roll out and are reported upon?
Yep, great question. I would say the default number is that 3.8, the so-called U3, which is this narrow measure and defined the way we've discussed it earlier. You may hear a little bit more about the sort of marginal attachment and so forth if you dig down into the third or fourth paragraph in your favorite, you know, news periodical. In defense of macroeconomists who tend to focus on one and say not both, part of the reason for that is that if what you're interested in, and I'm going to say this only half facetiously, but if what you're interested in is how the unemployment rate is changing over time, then, you know, if you're missing something, let's say in the numerator, and you know, you're not fairly assessing the marginally unemployed, well, in some sense, and I don't mean this to be crude, but if you make that mistake consistently every single month, then you can still take a look at the series and say something about where the economy is in terms of its business cycle. So in defense of folks who hang on to, let's say, that very narrow a headline number of U3, and they never call it U3, and sort of just focus on that. I don't know that they're so much willfully ignoring marginally attached workers and so on, so much as what they're doing is they're interested in how the unemployment rate is changing from one month to the next. And so the argument is, you know, as long as they calculate this number in a sort of a consistent, systematic way each month, then there's something to looking at the number between, as you did in the lead, and you said it was 3.8% for February. That's 0.2 percentage points less than it was in January, right? And so we can make that kind of comparison. And we know that in both cases, we are, you know, statistically speaking, ignoring the marginally unemployed. But it's not sort of in a dehumanizing way. It's just that we're trying to get a sense of how the number behaves over time. If you're looking at a moment in time, sort of a cross section of different individuals in and out of the labor force, then I think you really, if you're going to be responsible about this, you must look at these other rates as well.
How low can it go? So as we look at a 50-year low, and that seems exciting to many people, and we'll get into that in a little bit, whether that's all good news. But how low can it drop? Can it get to zero?
Yeah, we don't think so. We'd actually prefer it didn't. And this is because economists model the macroeconomy as having something we often refer to as a natural rate of unemployment. And we're not exactly sure what that number is, but we surmise that such a number must exist. And the reason for this really goes back to the nature of the broader macroeconomy. It's a dynamic, free enterprise economy. We are constantly innovating, which means we have all sorts of shifts in the economy. We suddenly need one kind of labor in Mississippi, and then we need a very different kind of labor in Arkansas, and then that switches again because of the dynamic nature of the economy. So at any point in time, individuals who are different in terms of their skill sets are looking for jobs that require different skill sets. And that's just something we call job search, or often just search for short. You would imagine that you always have some extent of job search if the economy is dynamic. Again, if you just play that backwards, you can't have innovative goods and services and so forth and not have the same kind of innovation and dynamism in the labor market. So macroeconomists reason that no, the number would not go to zero, because what that would imply is that you've got a sort of entirely static or placid labor market where no one is looking for an opportunity that best suits their skill set. This is perhaps counterintuitive, but I would go so far as to say some amount of unemployment actually grows labor productivity over time, because you are matching individuals to their skills in ways that actually leads to greater productivity in the future. So we don't think it can go to zero. Most estimates, and again, this is on the website, I plotted the Congressional Budget Office's estimate of the natural rate of unemployment, and it's higher than our current unemployment rate. So just, you know, ballpark measure, the CBO estimates that the lowest it could go in the long run is about 4.6%. And as you said in your lead-in, the unemployment rate is currently at 3.8%. So we are below any reasonable estimate of a long-run unemployment rate. That's not to say we are somehow defying gravity or something, but it's just we don't think that this would be sustainable long-term, because by definition, we define the long-term rate as a higher number than the number we see right now. So what's the takeaway from all this? The labor market is tight in terms of the quantity demanded of labor and the quantity supplied of labor. We have lots of job openings, and we don't have the bodies to fill them, again, in the aggregate. So all of this points to, as we would call, a relatively tight labor market. And 3.8%, I'm guessing your listeners, if they have any sort of sense of history of the unemployment rate that they've lived through, they realize that that is a very low number.
So often when we talk about the unemployment rate, it is an indication of public policy. So you might judge a president or and in at the state level, you know, you often hear the governor talking about the unemployment rate in reference to workforce development and to companies having a hard time finding workers. Are there policy changes and leadership, in a political arena that are somehow affecting the unemployment rate, and how so?
Yeah, This is a really big question. So the need for workers comes from essentially from a need to produce goods and services. And so you can think about macroeconomic policies that drive, we can call it sort of total or aggregate demand in the economy, the demand for stuff. Those sorts of policies that stimulate economic activity stimulate a demand for labor. A demand for labor is what we call a derived demand. You don't demand labor in and of itself. You demand it because you need the labor to produce something. So if you have a need for production, then you have a need for labor. And so macroeconomic policies, think, for example, monetary policy, which we'll talk about in future podcasts, where if the interest rate goes down, that can stimulate spending. That could create a demand for labor indirectly as a result. So those kinds of policies can certainly stimulate a demand for labor. In terms of a supply of labor, you can also think of policies like training, job training and so forth, where you have individuals who are attempting to, as they say, reattach themselves to employment. And it's possible, for example, government policies could train the workforce in such a way that that search process is easier than it might otherwise be. So sure, there are lots of policies. Some of them are, you know, above the fold, as we say, headline policies like stimulative monetary policy, low interest rates and so on. Others are have more to do with that natural rate of unemployment, again, helping individuals match their skills to employment opportunities. And if there's a skills deficit there, helping those individuals to build those skills. So workforce development programs certainly would be in the toolkit, if you will, as well. So yes, policy can shape the short-run movements in the unemployment rate, but it could also shape the long-run or so-called natural rate of unemployment by shaping how easy it is for an individual to find a new job, also shaping how easy it would be for an individual to separate voluntarily or involuntarily from a job. That will also determine unemployment rates in the long run.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. My guest, Joe Santos, he's professor of macroeconomics at South Dakota State University, and this is a segment we call Morning Macro. You can find a link at listen.sdpb.org, which will take you over to Joe's blog at schooled.blog.com. For school.blog, you're going to spell out the word dot, by the way, and that will help you get there. And Joe, I'm wondering, when you say the actual rate of unemployment is below the natural rate right now, is that unprecedented? Is that a cycle we've seen before?
We have. So again, the natural rate of unemployment is, of course, an estimate. And so if you take a look at the actual unemployment rate over time and you superimpose on that the natural rate, and yes, that's a figure on school.blog, you'll notice that the actual unemployment rate has gone below the natural during most business cycle expansions since the Second World War. Stays down there for a bit, and then typically the expansion is over and the economy begins to recess and the situation rights itself. So we are right now in a situation that you would expect to see in, let me just say, a long-lived business cycle expansion, which we are certainly in, roughly a decade long now, which is quite long in the post-World War II era. So yes, the actual rate does dip below during expansions, and it reaches its lowest level often right around the business cycle peak, just when we're sort of at our best day in the macroeconomy. That's typically when that unemployment rate is at its lowest, and typically below the natural rate. So there are these short-run variations around the natural rate, but we think of the natural rate as sort of the home to which the unemployment rate will ultimately return when the economy begins to right itself and slows from its current expansion.
When we look at the macroeconomic numbers of the employment rate, and people tend to take them and make comments about, I'm thinking of my dad who used to, you know, he'd drive around town and he'd say, everybody's hiring, you know, so there's no excuse not to have a job. Not all those jobs are good. Not all those jobs are not only fit your skills, but not all those jobs are going to pay a living wage for every family. So is that measured at all in the sense that it's just, how does that fit into measuring unemployment, the lower end jobs that maybe have wages that aren't meant to be the primary breadwinner in a family, for example?
Mm-hmm. That's That's a very good question. You're identifying a very serious problem, an empirical reality of the economy, which is some jobs simply do not pay well enough, do not pay so-called living wages. The unemployment rate, strictly speaking, is not accounting for that. So as long as an individual is working, I'll give you just an extreme example. If an individual is working in a family business and is not getting paid, if that's the response they give to the Bureau of Labor Statistics when they're called that month, the Bureau of Labor Statistics identifies them as employed. So what you're earning does not determine the condition, that is, whether or not you are employed or unemployed. That's a really good question. That is not something the BLS is concerned with. And as I say, as a sort of an extreme example of this, in principle, you needn't be paid. If you are showing up to work, for example, a furloughed employee during the government shutdown who showed up was employed, even though they were not being paid at that time. That's how the BLS handled that recent situation, for example.
And this goes back to sort of, you know, why does this all matter? Why do we understand the macroeconomic terms? Because the more you understand what exactly it is they were talking about, then you can make the proper insight into real life and how your day is unfolding, for example. Yeah.
Yeah. And the other bit of this is 3.8% is, again, it's just a number of people who reported as being unemployed. The other bit that is sort of disguised by that number is how many of those folks have been unemployed for a very long time. And so we can go into that, too, if you wish. But there's variation there. So I'm making this up. If there are 6 million people who are unemployed, some of those 6 million may be unemployed for 27 or 28 weeks. Others may be unemployed for 3 days. And so there's that kind of, we say, heterogeneity or difference in the data. And again, the BLS and macroeconomists study this sort of difference, but it's not reported in the headline number of, say, 3.8%.
And that's what I alluded to earlier about these human stories, because as you dig deeper and find out who are those people who are the discouraged workers and the people who are employed, unemployed for long stretches of time and are starting to give up hope, you say that there's some indications of even the impact of the opioid crisis on on those numbers. Elaborate on that, if you will, please.
Yeah. So when we look at the amount of people who are unemployed at any moment in time, this will sound a bit sort of odd at first, but so if you walk into an unemployment agency and there is a row of 10 seats and they're all filled, 9 of those people will be in those seats every week when you walk into that unemployment agency. It'll be the same 9 people. They will be long-term unemployed. And then that 10th seat will be occupied by a different person every single week. So the point is, most of the spells, we call them spells or sort of episodes of unemployment, are actually short term. Most people go into the unemployed state, if you will, and then exit the unemployed state, and they do so in a matter of weeks. But at any moment in time, that 3.8% number consists of a lot of folks who are sort of persistently in the unemployed state. And those are the folks who are often most vulnerable in terms of exiting the labor force as a discouraged worker. So again, most people go into unemployment and then exit unemployment and they're back with a job. But at any moment in time, there is a significant number of individuals who are sitting in that state of unemployment for several weeks and even months and potentially years. There's a figure there on the website your listeners can take a look at. But the median number of individuals who are unemployed for 27 weeks or longer, that's what macroeconomists think of as long-term unemployed, more than half a year, essentially. That number rose significantly during the financial crisis, during the Great Recession, rose to levels unseen during prior recessions. And then it has come down. But if you take a look at how it has come down, it is not as low as it was in expansions past. So there seems to be now this persistent problem of a group of individuals who are long-term unemployed. And as I mentioned on the blog, if you're going to address unemployment with policy, it really makes sense to address the conditions of the long-term unemployed. Those are the folks who are sort of sitting in that state for very long periods of time, and as such are again, forgive me for these terms, but their skill sets are deteriorating. And so their ability to reattach themselves to the labor, to the employed group is getting more difficult. So, you know, folks who are out of work for a week or two, it's not a great situation for them. But from the macroeconomy's perspective, we don't really need to address that with policy. Mm-hmm. You need to address the folks who are long-term unemployed. And again, if you look at the share of individuals who count themselves as unemployed, that share has long-term has grown over time. It's not 90%, but it was 9 and now it's 20. So that's gone up. And so that's a group who is most vulnerable in terms of likely to exit the labor force. And then that's yet another step that you need to overcome to get back into the labor force. And that's not something folks are inclined to do typically. So yeah, things like the opioid crisis, just changes in required skill sets and so forth. There are a lot of reasons economists have given for why we see this sort of marginal attachment in the labor force. And it starts typically with a state of long-term unemployment. That's sort of the first step to becoming so-called marginally attached.
Morning Macro with Joe Santos. You can find it on our website, listen.sdpb.org, and then you can click over to schooled.blog.com. Joe, thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Laurie.